to show you.
Good evening, and welcome to the 30th episode of the Sirens of Scream, the geek podcast that proves sometimes dead is better. I'm Melissa Megan, and I'm joined tonight by Jackie DeVore.
Hi.
Brain fart already. And Sierra Houck.
Hello.
These are my lovely co-hosts, who I do know their names, because I've been talking to them for over a year now. So we're going to jump. We have a really big topic tonight that we want to talk about. We're going to talk about scary tales, otherwise known as fairy tales, but they're scary. So we're going to talk about the scary roots of fairy tales and kind of the origins, where some of them come out of, which they're pretty much all pretty terrifying.
Yep.
I think the roots of all of them, so.
Wonderfully terrifying.
Yes. Yeah. This was a really fun one to research. I had fun.
Me too.
So first we're going to jump right into a couple of recs. We don't have a huge amount this week, but we have a lot of material to talk to you about, so I think that's okay. I'm going to jump, if it's okay with you, Jackie, I'm going to jump right into mine first.
Go for it.
I want to recommend a fancy Blu-ray box set that we have here in the house that I've just been playing around with over the last couple days, and it is the Hellraiser Scarlet Box, it's called. Hmm. If you're a fan of this, this old, well, I guess it's old. I don't think of it as old, but I guess it is now. Horror franchise of Hellraiser, which is one of my favorite classics. I'm a big fan of Clive Barker, his writing in general. This box set, and I'll tell you, I don't normally nerd out over box sets. That's kind of like my husband's dig. But this one is so beautiful that I had to talk about it. Box sets, if you don't know, are usually these huge collections of not just Blu-rays and the films themselves, but they usually come with like cool little books, and sometimes I think we have one for Battle Royale that's got like a really cool little comic book in it. All kinds of neat things.
I have one for The Crow that has a necklace in it. It's so cheesy. Oh, nice. Looking. I love it.
This one has got all the Hellraiser films, and then it's got a bunch of extra materials. Let me see. It's got Leviathan, which is the story of Hellraiser, a documentary on the making of Hellraiser. It's got Being Frank, which is talking to Sean Chapman on Hellraiser, the man who played Frank. Got a bunch of stuff, a section called Under the Skin, which is Doug Bradley, who's Pinhead, talking to him. Just tons and tons of extra materials to watch. And beautiful, beautiful artwork on each one of these discs. Like, there's such like creepy, weird artwork on these. I love them. And then there is a, let's see, there's this huge book in here. I'm digging through it right now. There's this huge, it's a 200 page hardback, hardcover book that is stuck into here. And is literally like just a, it's a tiny, giant book. Full of information about the film and the like biographies on different people who worked on it, and just I don't know that I'll ever make it all the way through this book, but if you know anything about Clive Barker, his history with Hellraiser has been a messy one. The making of the films and how he felt about all the different films, and you know, it's been messy, and so I find all of this information really, really interesting. One of my favorite things about this box set is it comes with these gorgeous art cards. They're like postcards. I'm going to hold them up so my co-host can see them. I'm sorry, you guys, you can't see them. But there's these beautiful art cards with
nice.
Yeah, with the Cenobites on them.
Yeah.
And Pinhead, and they're actually postcards, so you can send them.
Oh, wow.
With cool little Hellraiser things on the back. And there's this a tiny little comic book inside.
Oh, that's so cool.
Like a little Hellraiser comic book with all this cool artwork. And a big poster. So yeah, it's just gorgeous. And this is really cool too. The inside cover is I don't know how familiar you guys are with Hellraiser, but a famous scene says, "I am in hell, help me."
Oh, awesome.
When Frank reveals who he is and that he's stuck in hell.
Mm-hmm.
And he's asking for help. That's written on the wall in the film. So yeah, it's a really cool, like creepy box set that's just full of creepy Cenobite faces and bloody special effects and all kinds of stuff.
That's a beefy box set, damn.
That's huge. Look at this guy here. The Chatterer's mouth on the front of this one.
dang.
Yeah, just like all teeth everywhere. It's just so, it's so gross and awesome. So yeah, box sets are not cheap. This one, let me see, I just looked this up on Amazon real quick, and it's $78.99. Knowing my husband, he probably watched, I think he got this one from Arrow Films. They do their special little collections on there, and he probably found a deal on it one day and jumped on it. If you're a film buff and you like to collect fancy movie box sets and collections, if you're a horror fan, I think this Hellraiser box set is probably a must have, because this thing is gorgeous and I'm not even into collecting movies.
Yeah, that seems just, well worth it.
That's cool. It's just like this big giant box. It's a box with stuff in it.
I want to be the designer who puts together all those books and things and the packaging. That would be such a cool job.
It's even kind of like, he's got this cool kind of like puzzle box effect where like the pieces fit together.
That's so cool.
Yeah. That's my recommendation, Hellraiser.
Yay.
Jackie, you have something for us, right?
I do. I have something called the Thanatos Archive. It is an archive of an extensive collection of 19th and early 20th century postmortem, memorial, and mourning photography.
Yeah,
it dates back to the 1840s, and on their website, they have over 1,300 searchable scanned images. And it's very extensive, and they have a Facebook page and all this that you can follow, and they'll post very interesting details about photographs and interesting details about historical events surrounding death and just various death-like things, and it's all very, very cool. So if you have any kind of interest in historical photography, especially surrounding death, I would absolutely recommend checking out the Thanatos Archive.
Death, death, death.
Death, death, death. Death positive like all over this.
We are into death.
Yeah, we are. That sounds like a very deep rabbit hole that I'm going to go down.
Yeah, we expect to not hear from Sierra for the next few days.
I just opened it. I was like, liked. I don't even want to close that window. I'm afraid I might lose it later.
I literally had this tab open for the past week so that I remember to mention it on here.
That's the recs that we have for you this week. We're not going to go too crazy because, like I said, we have a ton of information to talk to you about. We're going to take a really quick break to make sure that we all have drinks ready for this big episode, and then we're going to come back and talk about fairy tales, or otherwise known as scary tales. We're going to talk about fairy tales. I don't remember how this idea came up. I think I just was thinking about bedtime stories, and I keep promising I'm going to read scary bedtime stories to you guys, and it will happen, I promise. And thinking about fairy tales and kind of where they come from. And I think we've all heard little bits and pieces over the years of kind of like where different fairy tales come from, and we all sort of have the idea that there used to be much more brutal, scary, crazy sort of versions of a lot of the fairy tales that we're familiar with, but we might not really know, you know, what the details of that are or who wrote those creepy old versions. So we dived into that.
Here in the present, everything's been Disneyfied, so.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're going to take it back. We're going to take it back into history and go back to when fairy tales were more adult material and more scary.
Brutal as fuck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, the oral tradition of fairy tales came long before the written ones. Tales were enacted dramatically and passed down between generations, which is why the history of their development is pretty obscure and blurry. What is currently identified as a modern fairy tale seems to have ancient roots in works like Arabian Nights, which is around 1500 AD, in the works of Taoist philosophers in ancient China, and the famous tales of Aesop in Greece, which was 6th century BC. Sometime in the 17th century, aristocratic women gathered in their salons, or living rooms, to enjoy a popular game that involved the hostess spinning reworked fairy tales, fables into new tales. The game's focus was both on showcasing decorative language, literary skills, and imagination, as well as on cleverly hiding critical political commentary in the stories about the conditions of aristocratic life.
That sounds fun, and I think we should have a dinner party like that these days.
Yeah. I find that really interesting, the idea that these rich women were kind of spinning these tales to try to, you know, criticize the government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But also showing off their vocabulary.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Showing off their vocabulary. Those ladies. Not surprisingly, the tales by women often featured young but clever aristocratic girls whose lives were controlled by the arbitrary whims of fathers, kings, and elderly wicked fairies, as well as tales in which groups of wise fairies, who were intelligent, independent women, stepped in and put all to rights.
Yeah.
I found this particularly interesting because I think in my ignorant ideas of fairy tales, I always assumed that the stories were the way that they were because they were written by men who were putting these stories out from their point of view of life.
Yeah.
So I find it really interesting to read this and kind of find out that women were actually turning it on their heads and they were writing the stories. And I never thought about the fact that all these girls in these stories are very clever and,
you know, a lot of them are aristocratic young girls. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting.
So, very interesting. Literary fairy tales appeared in works intended for adults, but in the 19th and 20th centuries, the fairy tales became associated with children's literature. The Brothers Grimm titled their collection Children's and Household Tales and rewrote their tales after complaints that they were not suitable for children. The moralizing strain in the Victorian era altered the classical tales to teach lessons, like when George Cruikshank wrote Cinderella in 1854 to contain temperance themes. Fairy tales have been used throughout history for everything from explaining the human condition to teaching morals and values to erotic fantasies. For the purpose of the show, we're going to focus mostly on those that were intended for children and children at heart, and comparing those well-known current Disney-style tales to their ancestral editions. Each of us have sort of decided that there's so many fairy tales out there that we could talk about tonight. The way that we're going to deliver this to you is each of us have kind of grabbed onto a favorite that we want to talk about, and we're going to give you little bits and pieces of what those fairy tales used to sound like, and then we'll kind of have fun picking them apart and talking about the Disney version that we all know today and how we see them. So Jackie, you want to start us out with this and tell us about your fairy tale?
Sure. The one I chose is The Pied Piper, which honestly, I was never really into that particular fairy tale when I was a kid. But in learning that it was based on true events, this has really caught my interest. So first, I'm going to read a little excerpt here from one of the earliest adaptations of the story, from Robert Browning's The Pied Piper of Hamelin, A Child's Story. When lo, as they reached the mountainside, a wondrous portal opened wide, as if a cavern was suddenly hollowed, and the piper advanced, the children followed. And when all were in the very last, the door to the mountainside shut fast. Now, the earliest known record of this story came from the town of Hamelin in Germany, and it was depicted on a stained glass window created for the church of Hamelin. And the window itself dates back to around 1300 AD. Wow. The window was actually destroyed in 1660, though. So this is, yeah, kind of a weird instance of events actually happening in real life, which happened in 1284. The year 1284 is when this happened. It was depicted later on in this particular stained glass window, and the actual story that was in the window was still a little bit vague. But it depicted a very, very colorful piper with a bunch of children following him and a mountainside with a hole in it. And then after this stained glass window was destroyed, the story was then passed down orally until it was written down and changed, and it very much developed and evolved over the years. So there's no solid record of the historical events.
Again, going back to that idea that, like, because so many of these fairy tales started out with oral stories passed down through generations.
Yeah.
It's really hard to pinpoint a lot of them.
Yeah. And the actual window, when the window was created on it, it stated in the year 1284, on the day of St. John's and Paul on June 26, by a piper clothed in many kinds of colors, 130 children born in Hamelin were seduced and lost at the place of execution near Köppen. Imagine you're living in a small town in 13th century Germany and 130 children just up and go missing.
Yeah, that's insane.
Yeah, and there's a lot of accounts of this will point to this story originating from a man who came to this town to get rid of the rats. He was hired as basically
what are these?
Yes, an exterminator. Yeah. Like, what is it called? He was hired as an exterminator to get rid of all these rats in the town. And the general idea that a lot of people believe today is that after he did get rid of the rats, the elders of the town basically reneged on the deal and wouldn't pay him. So what he did was he lured their children away and trapped them in a mountain, basically, as penance for not being paid for killing the rats. But there is no mention of rats in the earliest accounts of the story. Not in the window, not in the written accounts in the 1600s, nothing. None of it mentions rats. So somewhere along the way, rats were added into the story. So there are other suggestions here of why the rats are there and who the piper really was. First of all, the street where this occurred, the street where the children were last seen, today it's called Bugenlosenstrasse, which I'm probably butchering the pronunciation of, but it means street without drums. And you are literally not allowed to play music or dance on the street today. It is illegal to play music or dance on the street. So another theory is that the children died of some natural causes, and that the Pied Piper is a personification of death. And by associating the rats with the Black Death around that time, it's been suggested that the children were actually victims of the plague. But the Black Death wasn't actually severe in Europe until the mid-1300s, more than half a century after the events of Hamelin. So it's a little bit strange that people would associate that. It's kind of a stretch, really. Like, if the Black Plague had taken out that many children in this small town in Germany, it would have been a much bigger deal.
And why would it be personified as this, like, super colorful guy?
Yeah, it makes sense. Like, for me, I'm thinking from a parent point of view, like, you have to have a way to explain these sort of terrible events that happen, you know, to kids. Mm-hmm. And a good way to do that would be to sort of turn it into a mythical bad guy, or, you know, some kind of mythical thing that happens. So you can kind of turn it into a lesson for the kids, like, you know, don't eat rotten eggs or the Pied Piper is going to come for you.
Yeah.
Something like that to make it make sense for a child who doesn't understand illness.
Right. And to make it whimsical so that they'll pay attention.
Yeah.
The other theories on what actually happened the day of the Pied Piper are much more strange, honestly. One of the more kind of lighthearted ones, but not really, is that it was tied to an event in which a number of Germans left their homes to colonize Eastern Europe. But that would only, still, is only the children, so that's still a little bit strange. But the other suggestions are a good bit darker. One theory suggests that the children are actually sent away by their parents due to extreme poverty that they were living in. So they were just so poor that they just couldn't take care of these kids and sent them away. Another one suggests that they were participants of a doomed, quote, children's crusade, and may have ended up in modern-day Romania. This was also tied to the colonization of Eastern Europe, but also plays into some sort of a battle or a war that was going on there that I just don't know enough about to really talk more about that. And then probably the darkest depiction here is that the Pied Piper was actually a pedophile who crept into the town of Hamelin and abducted children during their sleep. But the end result here is that it happened. 130 children died randomly, and they just straight up disappeared. They actually never found their bodies. They just straight up disappeared in Hamelin, Germany, in the 1200s. But nobody really knows why or really how. So it's very interesting that this has developed nowadays into the story of a piper who came by to carry rats away. To lure rats away. But originally, this was a very horrific event.
Do you know if the mountain is like an actual location?
Yeah, exists? It's there. There's actually a cavern there in that mountain. Oh. Yeah, and it is depicted in early images of this particular event. And it was actually there in the background of the stained glass window.
Bet that place is haunted.
Right?
Jackie, I think you said that you really found this one interesting because it had some basis in historical events and not just kind of like folklore that was created randomly. Before we move on to the next story, I just wanted to share another one that I found really interesting that is also based in some historical or based on a historical figure, which is the story of Snow White. And this one, I found the same person named over and over and over again when I researched historical backgrounds of fairy tales. So it seems to be pretty solidly rooted in this one person. And that is a woman named Marguerite von Waldeck. She lived in the 1500s. She lived in a small community in northwestern Germany, and her family owned mines where children worked, hence dwarves. And basically, there were some political tensions between her family and the royalty in Brussels. So her father decided to send her to Brussels at 17 years old to try to get in good with the royal family there. And she attracted the attention of Philip II of Spain. And the story goes that she had a heated affair going on with Philip, and his mother was ashamed of his affair with her and wasn't happy about it. And she started becoming very, very ill. And she apparently had various letters that were sent home to her family around this time that became more and more indecipherable, and her handwriting was very wobbly in these letters. Tremors is something that's known to happen when you're being poisoned over a long period of time. You'll develop tremors, and she ended up dying at the age of 21, and a lot of people believed that it was Philip's mother who poisoned her over time to get her out of the way so she would stop messing around with the royal prince.
What a bitch.
Yeah. That was a short one, but I found that one really interesting.
Yeah.
And they said she was mentioned all the time in association with Snow White. So it seems to be pretty well established that that's where that story grew from.
Mm-hmm. What's with a lot of these fairy tales being rooted in Germany?
Yeah.
It's a little strange.
Well, if you want me to give you the quick timeline.
Yeah.
Of the authors that are most heavily associated with some of these creepy versions.
Yeah.
Let's see. The earliest one was from, I'm going to try really hard not to mess up these names. Giambattista Basile, and he wrote the Pentameron in 1634. What?
That's the one that mine's from. I think it's Pentameron or something like that. He's Italian.
Yes, a lot of his were, I think, the most brutal. Because a lot of his were kind of like reworked later to be less terrible. Then there was Charles Perrault in 1697, who rewrote many of these stories when he was a storyteller to the French court. But this was still, he was writing these stories for adults. They were being told to the French court for entertainment for adults. And then the Grimm brothers, who were German, their first edition was in 1812 and 1815. Something I never knew about them is they were really, really committed to only using German folktales. So, actually turned down several stories that were submitted to be used and because they didn't have German roots.
That's interesting.
Yeah, they were kind of snooty about it. And then there's Hans Christian Andersen, who we all know that name pretty well. He was in 1837. And then J.M. Barrie came along in 1902 and wrote Peter Pan. And with Hans Christian Andersen, Peter Pan was sort of like the beginning of, you know, the children's version of fairy tales, or when they were being watered down and softened for children.
Right. And Hans Christian Andersen lived in Denmark.
Okay.
So those would be Danish stories. Well, not strictly, but a lot.
Based, yeah. Well, and I think around this time, too, is when you started to see a lot of cross-pollination, but that's not the right word, where you see all these the stories are being kind of adapted in different languages and being picked out of baskets of various countries.
Right.
It's not so, like, secluded anymore, where, like, these are just French stories. This is where they start to kind of, like, coming together and being blended. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there was Disney, which started in the 1930s. I think Snow White, I want to say, is one of Disney's first.
Yeah. It was, I think it was actually the first feature-length animated Disney movie.
They're not all German, but German stories definitely, a lot of them, I think, came out of there.
Yeah, seeing that there was a real effort to pull German-based stories makes a lot of sense there.
Uh-huh. So, Sierra, which of these stories did you kind of fall for that you were most interested in?
I want to tell you guys about The Roots of Sleeping Beauty. Ooh. And this one is based off of a story called Sun, Moon, and Talia in the Pantamerone by Basile from 1634. And then this one, interestingly, kind of goes against what we all just said, but the Brothers Grimm adapted it in 1812 as Little Briar Rose. So I guess they took this Italian work and made it German. I don't know. But the original kind of earliest version of the story starts with this lord giving birth to his daughter Talia. And when she's born, he brings all these wise men and astrologers to come in and try to like tell her future. And they say that she's going to be endangered by a splinter of flax. And flax... And I tried to find if there was any kind of significance of why it was flax versus like just a regular old splinter or something, but I couldn't really find if it was supposed to be like a metaphor or symbolism or something like that. Hmm. So he commands that there's like no flax ever in the house or like spun into fabric, similar to hemp versus like when I first heard this, I was like flax seed, like from health stores. That doesn't make sense, but more of like a fiber kind of thing. And so she grows up. This story doesn't really say exactly when, how old she gets to before she falls asleep, but I want to say in the Grimm version, she gets to be 15 until she sees a woman outside spinning flax on a spindle, and she hasn't seen this before. So she goes out and asks the woman if she can try it, and of course she gets a splinter of flax under her fingernail, and she falls to the ground, and everybody thinks that she's dead. The father does this kind of creepy thing where instead of burying her, he just locks her up in a house in the woods, which at first I was like, why don't you just bury your daughter? Why are you trying to keep her around? Because you think she's a corpse. But I guess he didn't want to like go back to it. So it was kind of just like a crypt kind of thing. And so some time goes by and this king is out in the woods hunting, and he is using falcons to hunt, and one of his falcons doesn't come back. It flies into the house instead. So he follows the falcon into the house, and he finds Talia sleeping. So she's not dead. She hasn't decomposed yet. He like tries to wake her up. He's completely overcome by her beauty, and he can't wake her up, obviously. So he goes and he rapes her, basically. The line for the story is, crying aloud, he beheld her charms and felt his blood course hotly through his veins. He lifted her in his arms and carried her to a bed where he gathered the first fruits of love.
What a jerk.
I know.
He counts as love when the other one's sleeping.
Yeah, when she doesn't wake up, and then he just leaves. He doesn't realize that he has impregnated her with twins. so she's completely out. She is pregnant. She gives birth. The story says that fairies come in and help her and like take care of the kids while she's asleep and like put the twins on her breasts so that they can nurse. One of the twin like can't find the breast, so he like sucks on her finger instead and sucks out the splinter. So Talia wakes up and she's in this house alone with these two children.
This story is so creepy.
Oh yeah, and so she of course is like imbued with this motherly love for them, and she names them Sun and Moon, and they live in the house. And so this is like, you know, probably a year after the king had done his deed, and he just remembers that she exists, and he was like, oh yeah, that girl was really hot, I should go back to her.
Oh my gosh.
She's a gentleman. So he returns and he finds her awake, and he was like, hey, guess what? Those are my kids, and I'm in love with you. I'm a king. And she's like, that's awesome. I'm not creeped out by this at all.
Damn it, Talia. Get some standards.
Also, for some reason, she stays in the house and doesn't go back to her father, which is weird to me. They don't explain that at all. But the king, of course, is married to a queen. So he's like, hang out here. I'm going to go back and figure this out. And so he goes back to his kingdom. And when he's sleeping, he like calls out Talia's name in his sleep. And the queen is like, what the fuck? Who is he? That's not me. So she,
this
so
is like she, a soap opera.
I know. Well, and so Destiny's she, child on you him. Can understand why this is like what the ladies would like talk about and like share the story. But she
so funny.
Asks the king's secretary, like, who is Talia? What's going on? And the queen's like super scary. So the secretary tells her. And so she says, okay, cool. Go and tell Talia that the king says to bring his children here.
Tell that bitch he's my hoe.
Yeah, so the secretary goes out and tells Talia, the king wants to have your kids come. And she's like, yes, awesome. They're going to, like, be rich and famous or whatever now. So she sends her kids away with this stranger. And she stays in the house for some reason. And the secretary brings the kids back to the queen. And the queen is like, I know how to get the king back. I'm going to tell the cook to cook these children and feed it to him.
Oh, no.
So
that always works.
Yeah. And so she's like, well, this is a great idea.
The way to man part is his stomach. So
so she gives the kids over to the cook, and the cook is like kind of the huntsman character who's like, I can't kill these kids. These kids are too beautiful. So he saves the kids and like hides them with his wife and instead cooks two lambs for the king. And he cooks like 10 different dishes. And so the king is, like, eating these dishes, and the queen's sitting beside him being like, aren't these great? And he's like, yeah, this is, like, the best food. And then she's like, you're just eating your own. And then he doesn't, like, get it, and he just keeps eating. And then the queen says it, like, a couple more times, like, you're just eating your own. And he's like, yeah, I'm the only one who, like, brings anything into this house. Of course it's all mine. It goes right over his head. And so the queen is, like, not, like, satisfied with this. So she sends for Talia next. And the king is, like, off doing king stuff. I don't think he even realizes he supposedly ate children.
Just it sounds exactly things. Like it did in the 1800s, right?
And so Talia shows up. She's brought to the queen, and the queen is like, you messed up. The king is mine, whatever. And so I'm going to make a big fire in the middle of the court and burn you alive. So Talia's like, fine, but can I at least, like, take my clothes off and save my clothes? I guess to, like, buy her some time. And the queen is like, hell yeah, you can take those clothes off because I want to keep them because they're beautiful. So Talia's, like, undressing while this fire is being built. And as Talia takes off a piece of clothing, she screams in grief with each piece of clothing that she takes off.
So she's mourning her clothes, but not her children.
She's, like, not asking where her kids are at this point. Eventually, the king hears Talia screaming and comes and is like, what are you doing? And then the queen is like, you ate her kids, and now I'm going to burn her alive. And then the king is like, no, I'm going to burn my wife and the secretary and the cook instead because they betrayed me. Which is, like, reasonable, I guess.
What the fuck is going on?
Because, like, so he kills the queen and the secretary, and then the cook is like, no, wait, I have the kids. And he's like, oh, yeah, you saved them. You are, like, you can live, you're fine. And then the king and Talia marry, and the cook is rewarded with the title of royal chamberlain, and that's the end. And then they live happily ever after.
The story really took a turn.
The story ends with
happily
the line
ever after
with the line,
nobody's happy in that story.
I know. The story ends with the line, lucky people, so is said, are blessed by fortune even while in bed.
Oh my god, no.
When we first started looking up stories and stuff, I was like, okay, fairy tales are, they exist to, like, teach kids lessons.
There's no lesson here.
Yeah, and so that's why I chose this story, because it seems crazy, first of all, but then also because it seems more like it's teaching women how to act versus, like, teaching kids not to talk to strangers.
The moral is, don't fall asleep in the woods in a house by yourself.
Yeah.
I guess so.
Because you wake up with a new family.
Or, like, if your kid is supposedly destined to, like, get killed by Flax, maybe be a little better at watching her around Flax so that this doesn't happen.
Maybe sure, this is Flax, don't touch it, instead of...
Yeah, or maybe, like, don't rape people you find in the woods.
Yeah, that would, like, preferably...
That's also a good
How about just don't rape people?
Yeah. Maybe don't try to cook your husband's mistress's children.
Oh my god.
Well, but then I think that this also pretty much set a tone for a lot of fairy tales where women are either this, like, passive, beautiful woman who, like, gets super lucky and ends up winning everything for, like, not really doing anything besides being a mother or, like, being beautiful. Or you could be the older woman in power who's inherently evil.
Yeah, the crazy bitch that wants to destroy everybody.
And those are your only choices. Way. So, yeah. No, have fun.
I think everyone will agree with me that that was the best rendition of an ancient fairy tale I've ever heard.
I'm gonna 100% agree with that.
I would like to propose a new podcast idea, and that is drunk fairy tales. Yes. And I want Sierra to just drink and tell us fairy tales.
Side content.
I was just right reading all of these, like, feminist blogs about why Sleeping Beauty is, like, the worst thing that's ever happened to feminism.
Which it really is.
I can see why.
Like, honestly, even the Disney version is, but this version, holy shit.
Yeah, it's just all about, like, you be passive, and if you're good and don't do anything when the kings rape you, then you'll be fine, and you get to have a kingdom.
Lucky. Yeah, if you're lucky, you'll get raped into being a queen. Yeah, okay.
You know, I have to say I did not pick this one because it creeped me out so badly. I didn't want to repeat it.
So yeah, that's Sun, Moon, and Talia, the inspiration for the Sleeping Beauty.
I'm just, like, so disappointed in Talia. Mm-hmm.
I just feel emotionally drained after that.
Sorry. That's scary tales.
Okay. I'm gonna lighten this up, I guess, somehow, and talk about The Little Mermaid.
That is so not lighter.
There's no rape.
That's true.
I found this one really interesting, mainly because there's a drastic difference between the brutality of what we know as... I mean, I think all of us really loved Disney's Little Mermaid. I know when I was a, you know, like a preteen, that was like my favorite Disney song forever. All those songs from that movie. But the ancient version of this is very ancient. The old version of this is very, very brutal in a lot of ways. But I also saw a lot of, like, similarities, actually, in the way that the Disney film portrayed this story and the way that it was actually told. And that's what was so interesting to me about the whole thing, was just that Hans Christian Andersen's version, like, when I read, I'm going to read some of this and kind of give you the quick gist of what it was, and you can see a lot of similarities in when you watch that Little Mermaid film, of, like, you kind of identify things like, oh, that sounds just like, you know, a quick example is, like, in the Hans Christian Andersen, he talks about a forest of little, I can't remember what the word is they use for it. I think it's like polypi or something. They describe it as, like, little creatures that are sort of half creature, half plant.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And there's a forest of them that she has to swim through in order to get to Ursula.
Yeah.
And they have long grasping fingers, and they try to grab her as she swims by. And I thought, I remember those things. Like, they actually had those things in the Disney version, you know? They weren't quite as vicious and nasty sounding. Like, she saw, like, skeletons of various sailors who had sunken into the ocean, and, like, things that they grabbed through the years, and they were all, like, kind of iron-clad, like, in their claws, stuck in there. And then she saw the corpse of a mermaid who came before her that they had grabbed onto. So, you know, that wasn't in the Disney version. But I remember those creepy little, like, black squiggly things.
Yeah.
You know?
This was actually my favorite story growing up. Like, we had a book of Hans Christian Andersen tales, but my cousins had this nanny that was from Denmark, and she knew that I loved the Disney version of The Little Mermaid, so she brought me this book that was, like, gorgeously illustrated of the Hans Christian Andersen tale when I was younger, and I absolutely loved it. I'll have to send you guys some of the pictures.
It's really interesting. So I'm going to start it out with a quick quote, which was one of my favorite parts. And this is when the Little Mermaid first meets Ursula, and she's explaining what she sees. It says, "She now came to a space of marshy ground in the wood where large, fat water snakes were rolling in the mire and showing their ugly, drab-colored bodies. In the midst of this spot stood a house built with the bones of shipwrecked human beings. There sat the sea witch, allowing a toad to eat from her mouth, just as people sometimes feed a canary with a piece of sugar. I don't know who does that. I don't do it. She called the ugly water snakes her little chickens and allowed them to crawl all over her bosom. That is one of the weirdest lines I've ever read in a fairy tale. Basically what happens is, right, she just, like, very similar to what we saw in Disney, she goes to Ursula. Ursula tells her she can get her human legs, but the deal is, she says, I'm going to give you a potion that you can drink that's going to give you legs, but the deal is, first of all, I want your voice. And to get that, she cuts her tongue out and keeps her tongue. And she tells her that if she doesn't get the prince to marry her before the sun sets on the following day, or if he marries someone else, then she will turn into sea foam forever. And another part of this story that was a little bit different was that the idea, they sort of kept talking about the fact that humans have eternal souls that move on to some heavenly celestial place when they're done living, and mermaids don't. Mermaids live for 300 years, but they don't have a soul that goes anywhere afterwards. They turn into sea foam and they're just gone forever.
They just drift on the sea.
Yeah, so Ariel also really wanted, she really wanted a soul so that she could, you know, go on. Apparently 300 years isn't long enough for her.
I feel like that's a little bit better than, like, sacrificing your life for some man.
Well, she does.
Yeah.
She does.
But at least she's trying for, like, eternal life, maybe, hopefully, too.
Yeah, at least it's better that, like, she's searching for something other than just that prince.
Still not great.
Very similar to Disney, right? She eventually, like, she saves him. She's watching him. She's stalking him for a long time. She's watching him on his boat. And eventually the boat has a shipwreck and she saves him, pulls him up on the shore, and then she hides. And these women who are in a temple come down to the shore and they find him and they drag him up and they rescue him. And after that, she realizes that he has, like, he never saw her, so he doesn't know that she saved him. And she becomes obsessed with getting her legs. And that's when she goes to find Ursula. And she says goodbye to her sisters and the king, you know, just like Disney told us. Very similar. And then when she gets her legs, she doesn't have a tongue, so she can't talk and she can't sing. And Ursula tells her that every step she takes is going to feel like she's walking on knives.
Knives, yeah.
And she's going to be in terrible pain every time she takes a step. And that's part of her payment for having this opportunity to get her soul. Very, very tragic. And she gets up there. She, you know, she climbs up onto the beach and the prince finds her. So he brings her back. He thinks that she's beautiful, but they keep her. And it's terrible. They keep referring to her as dumb in the story. She's dumb now because she can't talk. She's dumb, which I don't know if that's actually what they thought that was, or if it was just an old word for mute.
Yeah, maybe it's a translation kind of.
I think it's an old word for mute.
So the prince takes her back and he takes her to his castle and puts some clothes on her and kind of treats her like a pet. Like, you know, I think you're beautiful, so I'm going to just keep you with me all the time and you can kind of, you know, hang out with me. So she sits and she watches female slaves performing for him. And they're singing and they have beautiful voices and she feels really terrible that she can't sing. And eventually they start dancing. So she gets up and she does this big fancy dance to impress him. And this impresses him enough that he decides he needs to have her next to him all the time. So he orders that she would be allowed to sleep on a velvet cushion outside of his bedroom door.
Oh, how, that's how lucky
how
for
he
her.
Rewards her for being the most beautiful woman that he's ever known. As the prince grows to love her, he explains that she resembled a young maiden who saved his life once. So the first woman he saw from the temple, he thinks saved his life, and he tells the little mermaid that woman belongs to the temple, so he'll probably never see her again, but the mermaid is a good enough substitute and reminds him of her, that he wants to keep her close by. This is what he tells the little mermaid.
So she's, like, slowly dying inside. Yeah.
So she's walking around feeling like she has knives stabbing her in the feet. So she can follow him around like a puppy dog and sleep on a cushion outside of his bedroom door.
And he tells her, her heart. Don't forget the knives in her heart.
Yes. And he tells her, well, you look a lot like a woman that I'm really in love with, so you can hang out for a while.
Jesus.
So a princess he was set up to meet by his parents. you know, the old days of arranged marriages. They send him off to this big kingdom to meet a princess, and he goes to meet her, and it turns out that she is the long-lost savior of his dreams. She's the woman mm-hmm. who was at the temple studying, and he declares that she will be his wife. And then he turns immediately to the Little Mermaid and reminds her of her devotion to him and that she should be happy for him while he's in love.
Ugh.
Yeah. So after he marries his new love, the Little Mermaid is sitting on his ship, gazing out into the darkness, and she's waiting for the sun to rise. She knows she's going to die. You know, she's got nothing left. They make a big deal out of talking about how the prince and his new wife go into this tent, their wedding tent, which is apparently popped up in the middle of the ship. So everybody's around when they go in to, you know, finalize their marriage that night. And the Little Mermaid's sitting on the deck outside the tent, just thinking about her death. And she looks out into the water and she sees her mermaid sisters come up to meet her, and they have all cut their hair. They've all chopped their hair off.
It was a big deal for the mermaids to have long, beautiful hair, like mm-hmm. decorated with pearls and stuff.
Yeah, they I think they wore like oysters and pearls in their hair to show like their royalty.
Yeah.
And where they stood. So they come up and they've all cut their hair off, and they tell her they gave their hair to the witch as an offering to try to save her. The witch gave them a knife that they hand to her, and they say, if you kill the prince before sunrise, then the Little Mermaid can turn back into a mermaid and live again.
As she was before. If she killed the prince's new wife, or maybe both of them.
The story that I read said that she had to kill the prince.
Okay.
And she stands over their bed in the tent and sort of like does a creepy, you know,
rising the stalker,
yeah, creepy stalker thing again, where she's like, and she's looking at the new wife and she's looking at the prince, and she decides that she can't kill him. And she's okay with him being happy, so she throws the knife out into the ocean, and she jumps into the sea, expecting to turn into sea foam. And this is where I don't know what the fuck happens with this story from here on out.
She ends up pretty black and white.
It was pretty clear up until this, like, the final paragraph of this fairy tale. I don't understand. She ends up being with someone called the Daughters of the Air, who are all these female entities of some kind who are working for 300 years to earn themselves an immortal soul so they can go to heaven.
Yeah.
And it's this kind of thing where, like, if they find good children that are making their parents happy, then they get like a year knocked off of their time, and and if they encounter bad kids whose parents don't like them, then they get extra time added on. So I don't know who the Daughters of the Air are. It was a bit of a weird twist there, where they just kind of throw those ladies in there like, yeah, she's not Seafoam. She's just with these other ladies who are spending 300 years trying to get themselves a soul.
Yeah, my understanding is that they were basically kind of in between being just Seafoam and having real souls, and they're just working to try to earn themselves a soul.
Hmm.
So by not killing the prince, the Little Mermaid basically at least earned herself the right to earn a soul.
It's quite tragic, you know, when you think about, like, she would have lived for 300 years and then turned into sea foam, or her option was to suffer immensely and become a human so that she could die in, what, 80 years, right? 90 mm-hmm. years, maybe. Probably 70 back then.
Yeah, or 60, like 40.
Yeah.
And then go to whatever place in the stars they believe in. Or, you know, her new option now is to exist in some kind of weird limbo mm-hmm. where she has 300 years to try to earn herself a new soul. It's not a happy ending. It's not a happy story.
Like, none of that is good.
Yeah. No.
And it's very frustrating. You know, you read it and you're like, oh, what? No, don't be nice to him. He's, you know...
Your sisters cut off their hair for you.
Yeah, the prince does not come off very well in that one.
No. He's like, you know, you're a really, really great dancer, and you're so gorgeous, and I love you so much. I'm going to give you this cushion that you can sleep on outside my door every night
mm-hmm.
because you're so special. I was like, what the fuck?
And everyone was probably like, you're such a good guy for helping out that girl who can't talk.
Yeah, probably.
You know, I'm reading it and I'm thinking, like, this actually doesn't feel too far off from what we saw in Disney.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's moments in the tale when you read it and it's like, oh, I remember seeing that, like talking about the king and her grandmother and like the sisters sort of coming up at night to the surface of the water and kind of pining for her, mm-hmm. and searching for her, you know, and like they're way out in the water and she's on the beach and she can just kind of wave to them, but they don't really understand what's happening and they just want her to come home.
Yeah. She didn't have a cool little crab friend though.
No.
Yeah, what about Flounder?
I was sorely missing.
A lot less singing.
Yeah.
Besides, apparently the prince has a lot of slave women who sing for him.
So it sounds like he's set. What an asshole.
I guess the moral is don't murder people, even if they don't do what you want them to do.
I don't think there's a good moral.
Or, like, be grateful that you have a soul, because look at what these girls are doing to try to get one.
Yeah.
I don't think the morals came along until they started adjusting these stories for children, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was when they decided, well, we can make them good for kids if we sort of give them all, like, good lessons to learn. We had I closed my Twitter. Our friend who wanted to hear about Hansel and Gretel. Josh, our friend Josh.
I want to say it was Josh, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He said he wanted to hear about Hansel and Gretel, so I'll just tell you briefly the story behind that. The tale of Hansel and Gretel could have been, this is another one that was a little bit blurry, so they kind of, you know, they're able to say, like, well, it could be this and it could be attached to that, but this one, there's no kind of solid background on it, like some of the ones we've talked about. It could have been told to keep children from wandering off, but during the Great Famine of 1315 to 1317 AD that crushed most of continental Europe and England, disease, mass death, infanticide, and cannibalism increased exponentially, and seeking relief, some desperate parents deserted their children and slaughtered their animals. Or, which is my favorite version, Hansel and Gretel might have stumbled upon the home of a successful baker known as Katerina Schraderin. In the 1600s, she concocted such a scrumptious gingerbread cookie that a jealous baker accused her of being a witch. They drove her from town, and a posse of angry neighbors hunted her down, brought her back home, and burned her to death in her own oven.
Man, I want to make something so delicious that people accuse me of being a witch.
Mm-hmm.
That's my new goal in life right now.
Yeah. This is too good to exist in the world. We must murder you. She's a woman, and she got something.
Yeah.
I don't know specifically, but I think there was also a early version of the story where the witch was actually the devil. I don't know what kind of repercussions that one had. I didn't read too much into it, but a lot of options there.
Yeah, well, like we said, you know, some of these, it's almost like very obvious who historical events and things that might be tied to them, and others have sort of, I'm sure a lot of these, like a lot of art and music and folklore kind of came out of churches and, you know, religious texts and things like that. So they've been manipulated and reinterpreted through the years, especially once they start crossing oceans and crossing countries and different languages. You know, people are going to put in, like, whatever their local folklore boogeyman is.
I'd say that Hansel and Gretel is one of those that even the modern, dumbed-down Disney version is still really fucked up.
Yeah.
We're gonna abandon our children in the woods, and they'll come upon a house made of candy, which, of course, kids are like, yay, candy. But it's also a message of, like, don't be gluttonous. And then they meet a witch who wants to eat them, but then they kill her instead.
Yeah, at least that one does actually have some solid morals in there somewhere. The gluttonous one particularly, or not talking to strangers. Mm-hmm. But damn, adults just suck in all these stories.
Yeah, adults are shitty. Also, it taught kids to leave a trail so that they can find their way out of a woods. That's a fairly good lesson.
And you know, white men don't come off too well in these stories either.
Mm-mm.
One of the other ones that I found super creepy and murdery. Murder. Bluebeard. And the roots of the tales of Bluebeard. And That one is, let's see, Perrault, who is the French writer that we talked about, wove his story around Connemar the Cursed, the Breton chief who had been forewarned he would be slain by his own son. Hmm. As soon as one of his wives became pregnant, he murdered her. Aww. But Perrault was also fascinated by, I'm going to say this badly, I'm sorry, I'm not good with French, Gilles de Rais, a wealthy 15th century nobleman, a hero of the Hundred Years' War, Joan of Arc's protector on the battlefield, which is why this is particularly interesting. After he left the military, he became a notorious serial killer of children.
Oh.
He was given the nickname Bluebeard because his horse's sleek fur looked blue in the daylight. At his shocking trial, he described in detail how he preyed upon and tortured innocent children. Perrault drew upon these facts to conjure up his own nightmarish character, Bluebeard.
Wow.
Yeah.
A lot of kid killing back then.
Right?
Which makes me think maybe that's what the actual thing that happened for Jackie's story is, that it was just
the Pied Piper.
Horrific serial killer.
Yeah.
And they probably exaggerated the number.
This is going to sound really cold, but it makes sense when you're talking about these, you know, old European, like, rural towns where there was just a lot of poverty and illness and plagues, that children were just less valuable, I guess, would be the way to say it. Like,
well, you have a billion of them because you assume some of them are going to die.
Right. I mean, there's no birth control, obviously, so people are having more kids than they can afford, and kids are, you know, and they can't afford to feed them, and everyone's getting sick.
Interestingly, I don't know if you guys watch Adam Ruins Everything.
Mm-hmm. No.
I love it. There was an episode recently about birth and motherhood and all this, and he actually cited some sources that back in those times that we're talking about here, where all these fairy tales are actually dreamed up, kids just died so much from just everyday causes that they actually wouldn't even bother giving kids names until they're a few years old.
That's terrible.
Yeah. They'd just be like, baby girl, Hauk.
Until they're five.
Yeah. Like, you only have two more years until you get a name.
Yeah.
Hang in there.
So it seemed like it was just so rampant and so widespread that, you know, maybe they just weren't really that attached to kids until they got older.
Another maybe reason why some of these are so graphic and horrible, especially around like cannibalism, that comes up in literature and stuff, of people saying like, oh, these people are cannibals because like we think we're better than them, kind of thing. So like, oh, this other, like these people who live over here, they're evil and eat children, kind of thing.
Hmm.
So it's just like racism.
Assholes.
Yeah.
Everywhere you go, the world is filled with assholes.
Mm-hmm.
That's optimistic, Jackie.
I am, like...
Except for everybody that listens to us. None of you are assholes.
Yeah.
Some of you might be. Yeah, just true. Kidding. We love you.
Anybody can download this.
Asshole-ish. I mean, that there's tons of them out there. There's so much that, I mean, we really had to, like, slice this down. We're talking about possibly reading each of these original stories for you guys and some extra content, because for some reason these old fairy tales are fucking god-awful long.
They are grizz as fuck. It's awesome.
They are so crazy. There is a comic book series, if anybody out there wants to delve into kind of modern versions of fairy tales. There's a long-running comic book series called Fables, which has been going for so long, I've actually not gotten through all of them, even though I love them, and I've got, like, hardcover collectors on my shelf. I still haven't gotten through them. But they did stop in July of 2015, so there is a complete series. This book ran from July 2002 to July 2015.
Damn.
I'm not kidding when I say it's a long-running series.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and this is a really cool story if you guys want to read some more about this stuff. What they did in this story, Bill Willingham is the writer, he took all these old fairy tale characters, Snow White, Beauty and the Beast, the Big Bad Wolf, kind of all of these, Red Riding Hood. And he tells a story where there's a war that happens in fable, in their fable land where they're from, and they have to escape. They're essentially refugees and they all have to leave and escape. And what they do is they sort of find a way to hide in this neighborhood in the middle of New York City. So they're like, they're glamored, essentially. Kind of like the vampire concept, you know? They're glamored, so people don't know that they're fairy tales. And they're living, and they all have to learn how to live, like, in a modern space.
Hmm.
The ones who are, like, people. The ones who can't get away as people, all the various animals that are based on these fairy tales, right? They get sent to a farm in upstate New York, where they have to live out their modern lives on this farm, where they're all kind of hidden away up there because they can't pass for people in the middle of the city.
Aww.
Wow.
Yeah, and there's like a whole like new community that is built with all these characters. Like the Big Bad Wolf ends up being like the sheriff, and Snow White is like, I can't remember if she's a mayor maybe of Fable Town, I don't know, but she's kind of the boss lady, you know, and like all these characters get their own kind of roles in the new society that they have to play. It's really cool, it's really fun. And Telltale Games also has a Fables game that you can play, which is all based on Bigby Wolf and Snow White.
Nice.
Who have a steamy relationship.
Ooh.
Spoilers. So yeah, that's something fun if we got you in the mood for fairy tales and fables and you want to continue that. What about you guys? Is there anything else that you wanted to share on this?
No, I don't think so. We could just keep talking about different stories, but then this podcast will be like 8 hours long.
One thing that I do really enjoy about these older stories is the very creative illustrations around some of them. I think maybe I'll post some of these illustrations I found to our Twitter after this show posts up, along with absolutely the picture of the stained glass window from the Pied Piper.
Yeah, that would be really fun. This is a topic that like we really had to narrow it down, because you can go into everything between the history of the genre and kind of like what's considered a fairy tale, where does it cross with folklore. There's different eras of growth of fairy tales and when they were used for different things and by different people. It just goes on and on and on. And then there's the whole kind of cross-cultural transmission when you start to get cultures that crisscrossed with stories and started to manipulate them.
Yeah, there are so many different versions of singular fairy tales. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not even diving into contemporary literature.
Yeah.
We kind of stuck with just, you know, Disney and kind of comparing our Disney films to those stories. If you get into contemporary literature, then there's a whole nother box of worms to open up on this.
It's not even a can of worms at that point.
Yeah, where are you getting your worms?
Box.
Where they
a
come
box
in
of
boxes.
Worms.
It's the more eco-friendly version.
Fairy tales don't use cans, they use boxes.
Mm-hmm. Barrels.
Barrels, not barrel of worms.
A barrel of worms. This is more of a barrel of worms, I guess, than even a box of worms.
Mm-hmm. I have a question.
Yeah.
That maybe you guys don't, because you're being put on the spot right now, so you might not have a really good answer off the top of your head. But is there a folklore fairy tale thing that hasn't been Disneyized or hasn't been modernized that you would want to see brought back? Because the one that comes to my mind is Baba Yaga. Do you guys know about Baba Yaga?
No, tell me about Baba Yaga.
Baba Yaga is my favorite witch. She lives in the forest in a house that's like a hut on top of chicken legs. And
I already love it.
Half of the time she's evil and half of the time she helps kids. It just depends on how she's feeling that day. But there's always kids kind of stumbling into her house and like trying to steal shit from her. And when she's evil, she like, there's usually like a cat or a bird or something there that talks to the kids and helps them get away. And they like steal stuff from her house. And then Baba Yaga chases them through the woods and she has sharp metal teeth that she chops the trees down and like eats the trees. And then as she's like chasing the kids, they throw the things that they stole from her, like a comb that like they throw it and it turns into this big wall, and like it's like stops her for a minute, and she like drinks a whole lake to like get to these kids. And then they always get to the edge of the forest and get away from her. And she, like, stands at the edge of the forest and she's like, damn you kids.
Like, shaking her fist and all.
Stay off of my lawn.
I love this.
She's just a nice lady who lives in the woods and these kids are always stealing from her.
Yeah, that's gotta be it.
Yeah. So I would love to see a Baba Yaga something.
That sounds awesome.
I don't know if there's one. I mean, Disney hasn't really touched on Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah.
Or am I missing something that is very mm-hmm. Little Red Riding Hood?
Well, there's that show Once Upon a Time and there's a Little Red Riding Hood in that. But that show sucks so much. Well,
and that show kind of did everything.
Yeah.
Like, I was going to say Rumpelstiltskin, too, and that, you know, he was in that show, but...
Yeah, the story of Rumpelstiltskin could be really fun, like, as a feature Disney film, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was reading about that one, and apparently there's a version, like, kind of early on, where she finally guesses his name, and he's like, damn, and then he stomps on the ground, like, because he's so mad, and he gets stuck halfway in the floor, and then he lifts mm-hmm. his leg up above his head and, like, tears himself in half and disappears.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. That's one way to get out of a situation.
He's got some serious anger management problems.
Yeah, he's a weirdo.
Yeah, I read that one, too. Yeah, I don't know. I never got super into fairy tales as much as I have mythology, like mm-hmm. Greek and Roman and Egyptian mythology.
Yeah.
But I know a lot of these fairy tales kind of, like, cherry-pick some of the themes from those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They just have a lot more magic.
Yeah, more fairies.
Yeah. Fairies and magic and poison. A lot of poison.
There's a lot of poison in fairy tales.
Yeah.
Guess because they didn't have guns.
Yeah. Well, and if poison is supposed to be like a woman's game or whatever, and then these stories were being retold by women,
mm-hmm.
that's just put two and two together.
I think the most interesting thing about this whole thing that I learned was this idea of how it was in vogue for rich women to sit around in Paris and tell each other fairy tale stories.
That honestly sounds like a really fun idea for, like, a modern dinner party.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I seriously might ask my local friends if they want to get together and do that, because it sounds super fun. You guys are invited, too.
Yay! Apparently, some of the most gifted female writers of the period came out of these salon parties.
Oh, that really makes sense.
Like,
yeah, which encouraged women's independence and kind of started the push against gender barriers. Back in the day. I'm going to mess up these names because they're French. Madeleine de Scudery and Madame de Lafayette were two that are named. Kind of the way back roots of feminist movement.
That's very cool.
Women sitting around writing crazy stories and trying to pretend they're not writing politics, but they are.
I love it.
No, we're talking about princesses.
It's just treasure. So cheeky.
Long hair.
See, look, we made the one that has independent ideas a witch. It's okay.
It's a mermaid story. I think that's going to wrap this one up for us. We have tons of ideas for extra content coming up, and we keep talking about it, and we're going to do it.
Yeah, we are.
Yes, I believe in us.
We can do it. So be on the lookout for that. We do have actually like an ongoing list of tons of stuff that we want to create for you guys.
Now if we just had an ongoing list of time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We may be talking about Stephen King for our next episode. But don't get too excited until we confirm that.
We've actually got a couple of cool Stephen King topics coming up, so stay tuned for those.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's going to wrap it up for today. Sirens of Scream is a member of the Mega Nerd Media family. Visit MegaNerdMedia.com for geek-related columns, reviews, interviews, and videos. You can send us your wonderful comments and questions and just say hi if you want to.
Hi.
Via our email at sos@MegaNerdMedia.com. And you can talk to us on Twitter or let Sierra know how awesome she is at Tumblr at Sirens of Scream. Jackie. Where can people find you on the big web?
I am Jackie the Robot on that series of tubes.
Sierra, give us that super complicated name that you use online everywhere.
I'm at Sierra Halk in the ones and zeros.
And I am at Lissa Punch on Instagram and Twitter. Thank you guys for listening. and supporting us and sending us cool stuff on Twitter all the time.
Yeah.
Soak and drink and mope and cross his arms and hope to die. And then a fairy came one night to bring the sorry boy to life. She pulled some strings, spun him about. That boy sprang up and began to shout. My arms, my legs, my heart, my face, they all burn. Show he was for real. And she would take those gifts and kisses, though just stringing him along. She knew about those wooden boys. It's an empty love to fill the void. Amongst the whales and the waves, and screamed, liar, liar, and his burning body floated away. He just drifted away.